Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, and thanks for listening to the Burke Allen Show live on the Blog Talk Radio Network from our studios in Washington, D.C. Our number is 718-506-1944, 718-506-1944. When our client and friend Homer Hickam, who wrote the New York Times best-selling book Rocket Boys, which was made into the motion picture October Sky, came to us to work with him on his brand-new sci-fi novel Crescent, we talked about the visual aspect of that book, and it really reads like a movie. And with Homer's background in film, being portrayed by no less than Jake Gyllenhaal, who played Homer in the movie October Sky, Homer writes in a very visual style. And one of the ways that you make a book special and make it stand out in today's world is to put together a very creative book trailer. Well, the challenge is that the book Crescent by Homer Hickam is set in the future, on the moon. It has lots of elements of steampunk. It has a very sort of retro Buck Rogers feel. And so building a book trailer, which is very much like the previews you see before you go to a movie, provides quite a challenge. And to answer that challenge, Homer turned to our guest today, filmmaker Pony Horton from Gravity Arch Media, who has a long background in Hollywood in visual effects. And Pony's going to pull back the curtain like the man behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz and tell us how all that Hollywood magic works. Pony, thanks for being on the show today.
I am the great and powerful Pony. Oh, ignore that guy behind the curtain.
You have an incredible resume, and you've had lots of ups and some downs in Hollywood, as many folks have done. But your real background, I guess, is doing this sort of visual effects work and doing it in a lot of sort of low and medium budget movies. And I sort of think of the Ed Wood film with Johnny Depp and the way that they were able to sort of pull that stuff off. Is what you do analogous to that sort of visual effects work, trying to you know, put it all together with bubblegum and baling wire?
Well, we actually, one of my mentors, who really didn't even know he was my mentor, a fellow named Bill Abbott, L.B. Abbott, he wrote a book about that years ago called Wiretape Special Effects, Wiretape and Rubber Band Style. He had been one of the head effects people at 20th Century Fox and later worked with Frank Vanderveer, and I had the pleasure of working with him one or two days on the first feature film I worked on in, like, 1979, I think. It was called 1941. It was a Spielberg film, and he was beyond retirement age at that point. I was raised with the physical effects world. We didn't have digital when I first came in, but it was soon to be coming. And so, yeah, there were physical models on blue screen stages on pylons, you know, and you would move your camera past them and do multiple passes. And, you know, we put together an effect in 1941 of searchlights by using long, thin, pointer-like rods, almost kind of like the things you would use as a pointer to point at a chalkboard, you know, if you're lecturing in class. And they were covered with scotch light, and they end up being searchlights in the distance over Los Angeles when Wild Bill is chasing Tim Matheson, you know, in the little airplanes during the movie. So, yeah, things like that were – I don't want to – you know, I mean, come on. Ed Wood, it's a funny analogy to use, but really he tried. I actually really like the story of Ed Wood's life and have done a little research on it. And his eyes were kind of bigger than his taste. He if he got one take and saw the people actually going through the motions, he was kind of satisfied with it. He didn't really there was no real finesse to his approach. It was just get the shot and move on to the next shot. And part of that was because there was probably not much of a budget, and part of it's because the thrill of getting something on camera can actually kind of sweep you up along and make you stupid. It can make you forget that you need to go back and really flesh stuff out to make things work on camera. It's not as easy as people think.
Pony Horton is our guest today from Gravity Arts Media just outside Los Angeles. He's a filmmaker and visual effects specialist and got a start in that sort of low-budget film world, although he's worked on some bigger movies like the Superman movies with Christopher Reeves in the 70s and early 80s, the Star Trek franchise. You've got a wide background with Star Trek. And also, you worked, I guess, early in your career doing effects with Roger Corman, who's sort of a legend in that low and medium budget sort of direct video drive-in movie franchise. Tell me what working with Roger Corman was like and what you did with him.
A lot of fun, actually. I have to say, Roger is one of the great old gentlemen of the film industry. I'll relate a story to you. I was doing glass matte paintings, glass shots, for some of his stuff. I got somehow involved in doing paintings of castles for his movies, and suddenly I was the go-to castle guy for a couple of years there in the late 1980s. And I would actually do them the old-fashioned way, which is on a big 4x8-foot sheet of clear shower door glass that I had specially mounted, same as they did at Vanderveer. They basically had this shower door company in the West Valley that would mount their glass for them, so I started using them too. And it's just basically a sheet of plate glass with aluminum or stainless steel framing around it, just like you'd see in a shower door, and I could mount these on automotive stands that could hold the weight, and you know, you could put them in any configuration relative to the camera. So I was doing these old-fashioned glass paintings, and the people at Corman's were just kind of blown away by that, because everybody's read about stuff like that, but most people don't really get to see it in action. And so the people there at Corman's were basically young folks starting in the careers in the industry, real enthusiastic. And I always had a crowd gathered around my mat stand. Three of the four movies I worked on were Wizards of the Lost Kingdom #2, that starred David Carradine, Mask of the Red Death, which starred Patrick McNee. It was a remake of one of Corman's own films from years before, and another one called The Haunting of Morella, which honestly, that matte painting I did in there was kind of, I should be ashamed of that painting. It was terrible. A kid could have probably done better with finger paints on that one, but it was a learning experience. And so, yeah, I got started early then, but actually some of the things you mentioned from earlier, from the late 1970s when I was at Vanderveer, I developed and processed film on movies like Superman. I didn't have any creative work to do on it, but I was the one who processed the matte films that are put into the optical printers to make the actual matting effects that you'd see. On 1941, I got to do a couple of creative things with the Searchlights, and on Nightwing, I got to do a week of animated rotoscoping of the climax scene, so that I actually got to do something really, really kind of interesting on that one. So,
and what is that? What is rotoscoping for folks that aren't in the industry? What does that word mean?
The most awful work in the world. It's horrible. Rotoscoping is where, in the old days, you would take a piece of film. If you needed to draw mats, traveling mats, a good example are the lightsabers from Star Wars. They had the saber rods there on camera, but they have to enhance them. So to do that, you take the film, a print of the film, you put it in what's called a rotoscope mat projector camera, because this is both a projector and it can act as a camera also. All you do is just switch out the movement inside, use the same lens, and away you go. You project the film onto a piece of paper, either 12 fields or 16 fields across. That's anywhere from about 13 or 14 inches wide to maybe 16 inches wide. These pieces of paper have registration holes in the top, and you mount them on registration pegs. Every single piece sits in exactly the same place as the piece before and the piece after, so there's no wiggle or movement. And you traced with a pencil the film onto each individual piece of paper corresponding to each individual frame of the film. And in the case of the lightsabers, you'd trace the shape of the blade as they'd wave them around. The rest of that piece of paper is then painted or drawn black, usually with like markers or whatever, and the area you trace is left white. When that's photographed on a high contrast stock, you get a traveling mat, black with a white sword waving around in it, and you can put that into the optical printer sandwiched over the film of the original, you know, lightsaber fight, and that white can be used as a glow, and it can be colored any color you want. So in the case of Luke, it was colored blue. In the case of Vader, it was colored red. And that's rotoscoping. In the case of Nightwing, I had to rotoscope people running in fear away from a bunch of burning bats, and they were running through a puddle of water at one point that was about 20 feet long and 5 inches deep, and so there were splashes. And I not only had to roto their bodies, but I had to hand roto the water drops and splashes as they flew up, because they had the camera about 3 inches from the surface looking across it. So that took me a week in the afternoons, from about 2 in the afternoon until about 4 or 5 in the afternoon, when I had to go to another job that I was doing.
So, you know, as a guy who just watches movies for the pleasure of it, I guess we don't really understand how much time goes into each minute you see, especially in a special effects film, how much minute you see each minute on the screen. It must take an inordinate amount of time to do these special effects.
People have really no idea. Unfortunately, with the computer, the abilities that we have digitally now, a lot of people are of the mistaken impression you just sit at a switcher and push button number 6B to get explosion effect in space. And it doesn't work that way. The computer has made the job faster and cleaner and a little less expensive and somewhat easier in that I don't need to use large machinery and I don't need to wait days for film to be processed. And there's a lot more precision, too. You can get a lot more precise with a computer than you ever could with an optical printer. And so it is a lot easier.
The company is Gravity Arch Media, and one of the things that you're doing that's interesting now, you and I both work with Homer Hickam, who is a best-selling author. One of his books was made into a major motion picture, October Sky, and you got together with Homer to work on this trailer for the book Crescent. And when that process begins, how does it begin? What does Homer tell you, and how much creative license do you have, and what does that collaboration look like?
Well, I'll say that it's different with every client you work with. That's the thing. Some clients want to be intimately involved. Others just say, just do whatever you think is good. I trust you. Homer was a little more intimately involved, but I like that because he had good ideas and we fleshed stuff out. Basically, I said to him, what kind of a thrust do you want to, show with this? What's the point you're trying to make? How long do you want it to be? How much money do you want to spend? And what do you want to see? And that's basically how you started out with everything, whether it's a trailer or making a commercial or even making a narrative film. So we just talked about it, and he wrote down a few lines. I said I gave him some format ideas, and we settled on the idea of initially a space chase, and then the people just kind of walking along and talking. And our first cut was a lot slower. It kind of came crashing down and slowed to a stop halfway through the middle when we changed the pace. So we kind of had to add. We went back and did a second and third cut. And we upped the pace up a little bit while still keeping the kind of the walking theme. It just didn't bog down. That's basically it. It was really mostly the special effects and getting all the resources to make a film together that's difficult.
If folks want to see the trailer for Crescent that we're talking about, it's posted at homerhickam.com, and that's H-I-C-K-A-M. This is shot, this book takes place on the moon. Obviously, you can't film on the moon, so how do you find a place that looks like the moon for these moon miner characters to walk around? How do you do that?
Well, here's the secret. We really did go to the moon. We paid NASA. We went up there. We held our breath for a while. We still owe them some money, but don't say anything about it. No, I'm fortunate in that I live in Southern California where you can get any environment you want, so I live very close to Edwards Air Force Base. And I know that there's all kinds of rock formations and mining areas out around there, and in the same area where Blazing Saddles was shot, the exact same area where the town of Rock Ridge was built, we went out and just found some good rockscapes, and we had weather contingencies. I needed a day with a clear blue sky, just a straight, flat blue sky, no clouds. And we got that, but it was a bit windy. Luckily, the jumpsuits they were wearing were stiff, so there wasn't any real issue. But I did have a lot of erasing of plants to do. There were still some foliage we couldn't get rid of, and I had to erase them or disguise them as rocks. But basically, I took the blue sky and just simply used the blue screen or green screen techniques to drop the blue sky out and put space and Earth in the background, and then just change the contrasts on the foreground footage to look more like it was under harsh sun, and that's pretty much it.
And Pony Horton, by the way, is our guest today. If you have any questions for Pony, the number is 718-506-1944. He's a visual effects specialist from Los Angeles. The company is Gravity Arch Media. Little things like the spacesuits that these guys wore. Is there a place in Hollywood that you can go and say, I want to rent spacesuits for this book trailer that I'm filming? How do you
Yes, and there was a fun story about that, too. My first thought was I wasn't sure who to talk to, so I called a special effects friend of mine who does a lot of Star Trek work because I know that he has things like that. And I said, where can I get a couple of space helmets and maybe some spacesuits? And he didn't know, and he said, try Western Costume. Okay, so I tried them. They used to have stuff, but they don't rent it out. They don't have it anymore since they disbanded a lot. They said, here's the company that actually makes them for the movies. specifically in Burbank. Tried them. I did. And one, they couldn't separate a spacesuit from a helmet. And two, I didn't have the money they needed. They wanted a minimum of like $1,500 for a day for one suit. And that was almost our budget. I didn't have that. So
right.
I thought, let's go to the source to begin with. I called NASA. Edwards Air, NASA Dryden out near Edwards. And they said, well, yeah, here's a guy who might know. And they put me in touch with somebody in their, I think their library department. And he knew a guy over in town who collected spacesuits and helmets from the 1940s on up to now. Put me in touch with the guy. The guy rented me two helmets for $50. The jumpsuits were just a couple of surplus Army jumpsuits from the surplus store that I rented one and bought the other. And that was pretty much it. Those spacesuits came with, those helmets came with almost everything we needed, hoses and accoutrements, and we just simply attached a couple of red aluminum water bottles to the hoses. It looked like small air tanks, and we used some motorcycle padding, and we were good to go.
Wow. Tony Horton is our guest. It's Gravity Arch Media if you want to look him up online. Back with more with Tony and his work with Star Trek right after this on the Burke Allen Show. Hang on.
Over 14 million people witnessed his emotional story of survival and triumph on national television.
I've been doing this, you know, for so long, like ever since I was a kid.
Millions more voted him their favorite in a landslide win.
The winner is...
And now, you can be a part of the experience live.
Landau Eugene!
Landau Eugene Murphy Jr.
Ain't that a kick in the head?
Your America's Got Talent winner.
I've got you.
Landau Eugene Murphy Jr.
Under my
Live. Performing classics from the Great American Songbook and his Columbia Records debut CD, That's Life.
That's Life.
Landau Eugene Murphy Jr.'s That's Life Tour. The one concert event this year you absolutely can't miss.
See Landau Eugene Murphy Jr. live in concert this summer. Concert dates available at LandauMurphyJr.com. Hi, and thanks for listening to the Burke Allen Show. We're live in D.C. Our number 718-506-1944, talking Hollywood and special effects with special effects guru, Tony Horton, from Gravity Arch Media in Los Angeles. Now, you have something to do with Star Trek, but it's a whole different kind of take on Star Trek. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I work on a web-based series called Star Trek Phase 2. It's also known as Star Trek New Voyages. These are what used to be referred to as fan films, but more and more of the film community are just referring to them as web TV series now. I have been contributing visual effects to the show for 10 or 11 episodes now, for about, I guess, 6 or 7 years, since the two-part episodes Blood and Fire.
And with these, episodes, is there a way to, you know, as a business person, to monetize this, or is it really something you do for fun? You're passionate about it because you're a huge fan.
That's basically exactly what it is. I'm highly passionate about Star Trek. I have been ever since 1966 when the show first, you know, came out. I'm old enough to easily remember that. And when I found out that they were doing this on museum-quality reproductions of the original series sets, I said I had to be involved. And I started with doing transporter effects and then quickly started doing set extensions and matte paintings. And then I got invited to start joining the filming, and I've done some guest acting on a few episodes, as well as doing a lot of on-set paintings. If I'm bored and, you know, didn't have anything to do with on the set that day, I'd just grab the nearest piece of masonite and some of the house paints and spray paints that they'd be lying around, and I'd throw together some kind of a spacey-looking painting, you know, in 45 minutes or an hour, and it would end up hung on the corridors or in Captain Kirk's quarters or in the transporter room. And people seemed to be really impressed with that. It's just nothing more than graffiti art with spray cans, but it's, instead of being graffiti, it's a planetscape or something like that. But it's fun, and you know, so those are some of the things that I do, and I've been lucky enough that I've been getting an acting career kind of off the ground a little bit, and Phase 2 has allowed me to do that. To be honest, I'm doing it not just for the love of Star Trek, but I'm hoping that the work that I do here can lead me to other paying career work when people see it and go, hey, this guy's good, let's hire him.
Where can folks see these Star Trek episodes?
They're online. You can see them on YouTube. You can see them on Star Trek Phase 2's website. All you need to do is just Google Star Trek Phase 2 or Star Trek New Voyages. As a matter of fact, an episode that's been awaited for years now called Kitumba is finally being finished in post-production. I actually have myself one or two more visual effect shots to finish up on it. First act has already been shown to the people intimately involved. It'll be up for the public probably the next few months, but it's finally getting done, and it looks great, and I'm a guest star in that show.
Pony, tell me something that would surprise people about the folks like yourself who work behind the scenes in Hollywood. What do we not know about that business if we're just casual movie fans?
You'd be amazed how many folks of us at Phase 2 at least work for the post office. A lot of them work for the post office. I haven't figured that one out, and there are a number of doctors also. I would say that the thing that a lot of folks don't realize is how immensely talented and intelligent the majority of these people who are doing this stuff are. These are people that if they weren't doing their regular jobs and probably hadn't had some of the creative drive driven out of them by society, they'd probably be, you know, the next ILM people or Orson Welles people or stuff like that. It's sad in our society that a lot of people who are creative get talked out of that by the time they're at an age where they could actually start pursuing something like that for a living. I consider myself lucky. I had to deal with some of that, but I've got a hard head and I'm stubborn, and I wasn't going to, you know, give up on my dream. But that also incurred sacrifices on my part. I chose not to get married or have children because I knew that it was going to be selfish to do that if I was to try to start a family, so I made a choice. But yeah, a lot of these people are very smart and very creative. A lot of the outside folks don't know that. They think we're just kind of geeks and nerds, and that's not necessarily fair.
Yeah,
but
and
it's true.
You talk about the challenges that you've been through, and it's been really up and down for you. And I read on IMDb that you actually have been homeless several times in your life, I guess, in pursuit of that next paycheck and to stay in the film business. Is that right?
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of a moment in an old episode of Emergency where they in the ER, Dixie McCall was dealing with some guy on LSD who'd leaped out of a window, a tenth-story window, decided he liked it so much he thought he'd try it again. That's what the homeless thing is like. You know, you'd think that I would have learned, but I haven't. And, yeah, there have been several occasions where I've either lived in my car or had to live in a camper or a trailer or in a few cases on the streets and or on friends' couches. But I have not financially done nearly as well as I could, but creatively at least I've been somewhat satisfied. I've had some creative success, and I've met a lot of interesting people and gotten to do some interesting things and film some interesting stuff. Basically, those of us in the movie industry have a phrase. It's really about memories, friends, and 8x10s. I'm not in the union, so that's another reason that I never did well financially, is that I'm just an independent guy, and I never had really a company or a corporation behind me. I'm just an independent person, and that kind of died out in the 1980s. It's hard to make a living as an independent anymore. Back when I first started as a mat artist, you could, but not so much anymore. You really have to work for a company now.
You have another interesting sidelight that I saw. You built bullwhips for a movie called The Ice Pirates, and you've sort of become this whip guy out there. And I guess there is, demand for a guy that knows all things about whips, you know, like Harrison Ford used in Indiana Jones.
Well, as a matter of fact, Anthony DeLonges, who trained Harrison Ford in the last film, is a good friend of mine, and he's trained me too. Yeah, I got into the whips after the first Indiana Jones movie in 1981, and I've never looked back. And I have a number of friends, thanks to the internet now, in the whip community who have made whips for the Indiana Jones films and are, you know, teachers and trainers. And so thanks to the internet, I've been able to increase my ability a great deal. But I've been collecting whips and playing with whips and doing Indiana Jones impersonations for years now. So. Yeah, it's a lot. I made some whips for the Ice Pirates. That was a job that was given to me, farmed to me by Ellis Mercantile, a place that doesn't exist anymore. But they used to be a big prop rental house in L.A., and most of the big movie companies went to them at one point or another. They had a huge room full of nothing but whips, and I told them that I could repair some of their whips, and they handed me some whips to repair, including one that Barbara Stanwyck had used in The Thornbirds. That was a stock whip. And then a few months later, they called and said, hey, we got this movie, The Ice Pirates. They need some whips that you can hit people with without hurting them, but will still crack and have a scabbard like a sword on the handle. And I said, okay. And so I made six or seven of them up, and they worked. And they invited me down to the Wizard of Oz stage on the day that they were using them. And I think Mary Crosby was one of the people filming. And Robert Urich was one of the nicest people you'd ever meet in your life. He was a star of the movie and a great guy. So I got to watch them use my whips for the day on the day that, on the soundstage they shot The Wizard of Oz on.
Wow. And Pony Horton, our guest today, is with Gravity Arch Media in Los Angeles. He's a special effects guy. And you mentioned a couple of names of famous actors. Nice guys in Hollywood that you've met, the names that we might recognize.
Oh, wow. Ralph Bellamy was nice. Louis L'Amour was nice. Victor Isay, one of the great old character actors from Gunsmoke and later in the Billy Jack movies, was nice, and Tom Laughlin and Dolores Taylor, they're nice too. James Garner, one of the friendliest, nicest, sweetest people you will ever meet in your life. I was on the filming of the Rockford Files on location once, and because the guy that apprenticed me into the industry to begin with did sound on Rockford Files and later on Taxi. James Garner was so friendly and so nice, and when tourists would want to come up, you know, from like the Midwest or wherever and take a picture with him, he'd grab the camera and start taking their picture for them, and he'd have fun with them, and it was just neat. David Carradine was nice once he got to know you. Patrick McNee was very, very friendly. I've met far more nice actors than not. John Voight was one of the best that I worked with. I worked with him on two movies, and I actually worked for him on a couple of movies, and he even helped me on a matte painting one day in Pasadena when I was doing a glass painting, and I was actually on set doing some adjustments to the painting, and he came over, asked if I needed some help. I said, sure, grab that masking tape and mask those lines off, and he did. And really nice fella. So, yeah, I've had some really wonderful experiences with the people in Hollywood.
Yeah, and Pony, you know, we started the conversation talking about Homer Hickam and the book trailer for Crescent, and I'd like to wrap up there. We have lots of authors who listen to the podcast, and if an author wants to do a book trailer for their book, where would you recommend they begin? If you were advising an author who reached out to you about this, you know, how do you start that process?
Edit. Cut down whatever you think you want to say. Cut it down to one third. You're always people with their own creative projects, I've found, tend to oversell. And it ends up looking like an electronics store window down in Hell's Kitchen, you know, in Lower Manhattan. If you've been there, you know what you can't read anything. It's all a jumble of stuff. They stick everything. It's like the scattergun approach. That's the mistake too many people make. The best approach is to actually keep it simple. If anything, I'd say just take one or two scenes and just emphasize those and boil them down to their essence rather than being very wordy.
And is it possible, you know, in most cases to do a book trailer reasonably inexpensively? You I think, mentioned a budget of Homer's book trailer being somewhere around $1,500 or so. That, to me, seems very reasonable when I look at those incredible special effects.
Well, that's very low, and I did that as a special thing. I would say that kind of a trailer could easily cost somebody between $6,000 and $12,000. Part of the thing is, and I can't do that again, I'll tell you why. It was just my partner and I doing it and the actors, and we had to set up entire sets ourselves. By the time we were done, I'm 55 today, he's in his 60s, we're too old for this kind of stuff anymore. God gave us crews for a reason, and crews cost money. We had to buy insurance on this. We had to buy over $1 million worth of insurance on this, and it did go over the $1,500. We had to buy film permits. We had to pay people to use facilities. We had to pay actors. And if we had to do it again, we'd have to have a professional crew come in, and that would be at least 5 to 10 people, each making about $200 a day. So you can do the math. I would say to anybody wanting a trailer, be prepared to spend on average $4,000 to $6,000, and you'll get something good. You'll get something worth it. You'll get something very good. But if you try to nickel and dime and cut back, you're going to end up frustrating the people doing the trailers, whether that's me or others, and you're going to end up with a product that you don't like.
Fair enough. The company Gravity Arch Media does these very high-quality trailers, and as I mentioned, if you haven't seen this trailer for Crescent, you can check it out at Homer Hickam's website, homerhickam.com. It's also on YouTube, where you can pull up the title Crescent and Pony Horton, the filmmaker, and it is intentionally a very retro feeling. It has this Buck Rogers sort of steampunk feel, which I think gives it a very unique look. If folks want to reach out to you and find you and talk to you about your film work or your book trailer work, what's the best way for people to find you, Pony?
They can email me at my email address, which is ponyrhorton@gmail.com. Just run the name all together, or just Google me. I mean, how many other Pony Hortons are there?
I think you may have the market cornered on Pony Hortons.
Yeah, yeah. So you can reach me that way directly, or you can leave a message on my YouTube channel, too. I'll get that.
Fair enough. Pony Horton's been our guest today. The company is Gravity Arch Media in Los Angeles. He's an American filmmaker, journalist, and an actor you can catch on those webisodes of Star Trek. Pony, thanks for being on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Burke. Take care.
You bet. Bye-bye. I'm Burke Allen, live in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Thanks for listening. Now, go out and make it a great day.